Listen to KISU live on your home's Amazon or Google smart speaker by telling it, play KISU. This is KISU FM, Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg.
Good evening and welcome to Know Your Media. In this episode, Drs. Malga Ock and Betsy Bruner look at the medium of books. Their guest, Dr. Raelynn Schwartz Dupree, will talk specifically about the children's classic Curious George to unpack the various representations found in these familiar tales.
Welcome to Know Your Media.
I'm Malga.
And I'm Betsy. This week, Malga and I are back for this month's episode. We've covered a number of topics thus far, including everything from fake news to the role of science in the media. And when we think about media, a lot of times we think about television and radio and social media, but books are an important medium as well.
And let's face it, I love books. I still have hardcover books at home, softcover books as well. So this episode should be interesting.
Okay. And what we've done is we're inviting our guest, Dr. Raelynn Schwartz Dupree, here today to talk with us about books. She's joining us from Western Washington University, where she's a professor of communication studies. We are very fortunate to have her here at ISU, not only as a guest on Know Your Media, but as a keynote speaker at the Intermountain Gender and Sexuality Conference that took place this past weekend on the ISU campus.
Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to start today with a really tough question, actually. We know that you write about post-colonialism and that you've looked at it in relation to Curious George, one of probably a lot of people's favorite childhood books. So first, let's start by talking, what is post-colonialism, simply put?
So post-colonialism emerged as a theory of intellectual cultural study after the primary decolonization of European colonies. So around World War I, about 85% of the world was occupied by European colonies. And after the decolonization of many of those areas, post-colonial studies emerged as a response to a traditional era of European colonization. So it was signaled by a series of independent movements, and it considers the historical and contemporary ways in which discourses, language, and symbolism colonize knowledges, ideas, peoples, and communities. So it the contemporary understanding of post-colonial theory is not a project preoccupied with the past, but is instead an investment in understanding why the conditions of the present are how they are and how and what ways they're informed. So I understand post-colonial studies as an intellectual, cultural, textual mode of analysis and a political movement that's committed to two ends. One, the critiquing and resisting of inequalities, power imbalances, Eurocentric research methods, master narratives, spatial homogenization, and also a interventionist project that actively seeks to promote decolonizing present scholarship and inviting space for new theories of knowledge production and anticipates a future beyond colonization in all its forms.
So let's back up a little bit too. What is colonialism and what different countries were colonized?
Well, around World War II, about 85% of the world was colonized by European countries of a various different sorts. The United States is traditionally understood as uncolonized in a historical sense, but in a more contemporary sense, there's actually a real long history of settler colonialism in the United States, not only for the First Nations people, but also for the ways in which we threw out the British.
So I find this really interesting from a political scientist viewpoint that the U.S. is considered not a colony. Because in my mind, it was the British who colonized America, and the U.S. is simply an early independent colony from the British Empire. So why do we not talk about the United States, or why don't we understand the United States as a former colony? Because when we look at Australia, we very much still think of Australia as a former colony of the British Empire.
So historically, when post-colonial studies emerged, it didn't consider the United States. But in the last 10 to 15 years, and the new wave, the new critical turn of post-colonial studies, does draw a lot of attention to the United States, both as the relationship to the British and U.S. people, but more specifically now looks at the First Nations people and Indigenous people who are here. And one of my interests in contemporary colonialism looks at the ways in which our relationship to First Nations people, Puerto Rico, Guam, still emulates a history of colonialism that is insidious and violent and continues those practices.
So I think that is a good gateway to actually ask you, why is postcolonial studies important? Because as you said, we no longer have colonies in the traditional sense. So why do we still talk about postcolonial studies?
Well, the aim of contemporary colonial studies looks at how the present is informed by violence of the past and how the future embedded in globalization continues to produce inequalities, injustices, and intolerance. As a rhetorician, I am interested specifically in how these beliefs are taught, understood, and maintained by public discourses. So I'm interested in how public, in a very Burkean sense, of how public uses and understandings of symbols lead to actions and attitudes of people, and how visual images, magazines, films, and other public media are invested in maintaining historical beliefs of occupation.
Can you give us a good example that our listeners can relate to what this means in practice?
Sure. So I've written extensively about National Geographic as an example. A lot of people have heard of the magazine. And since its inception, National Geographic has generally been considered an educational journal worthy of collection and value. But what a lot of people don't know is that National Geographic as a global enterprise has a long history of working with the U.S. government. Its representations of people in the majority world are mostly depicted as backward, exotic, intellectually immature. And there's much to be learned. But what's interesting about National Geographic is that this April's issue marks a new turn for the magazine. For the first time ever, they have a Jewish woman as the head of the editorial board. And to to honor the 50th anniversary of MLK's assassination, they have come out with an issue that recognizes their own racism and are making an attempt to acknowledge the ways in which their magazine has disenfranchised and unfairly represented people in the majority world. And so it's interesting to see whether or not this issue will make a difference for them.
So this is really interesting that you bring up National Geographic, because I think in my in-laws' basement, there are probably 2 or 3 decades worth of issues. So first, I should keep them. Is what you're telling me. They have collective value? No? Maybe?
As a researcher, I think it's interesting to keep them, but I think that if you're going to learn about the rest of the world, there are certainly better places to go.
Because I think when I look back at National Geographic, reading through them as a child, and I grew up in Germany, so even there we had National Geographic. It's really worldwide, I guess. And it was almost like a look in this hidden world of those primal human beings and what they would do in their tribes deep down in the jungle. So I can see this idea you just described, that through magazine, through photos, we tell a story that shape how we see the world. We're not discussing them as maybe very skilled hunters who can tell you if 2 days ago there was a male pig in the forest, or medicine culture that rivals Western medicine as well.
Well, I was wondering, in this new episode, since National Geographic is taking a turn, I know images are a huge part. I mean, part of the reason why people buy National Geographic is because it has such cool, quote-unquote, cool pictures in it. So as they make this turn to not trying to construct other cultures as other or trying to construct them as exotic, did you notice a shift in the imagery? Because it's a difficult thing to do. So I'm just wondering if they were able to. I know that you could write about it, but how do you image that?
So I study visual rhetoric, and one of the challenges of studying visual imagery is to determine where the image ends. So does the image include the caption? Does the caption anchor the image? Are they in contest? What is the relationship? And so I think National Geographic did an okay job of trying to reform their image. But what they did for the most part is try to move forward by recognizing new types of representation rather than really re-articulating some of the harms of the past. There was a small editorial note at the beginning that said, you know, here are some of the things that we did bad, we'll try better.
So we talked about National Geographic, which more or less is a picture book with a little bit of text. No offense, National Geographic, your photos are amazing. But how does this now link to books? Because most of us read books that do not have pictures in them. So can you tell us a little bit about your research on books and how the link occurs?
So while I enjoy reading fiction, I, for the most part, read scholastic books. My academic life and my leisure reading time are very much intertwined. So my new relationship with children's books was spurred 8 years ago by the birth of my daughters. And it was there I really was able to see how children learn from birth some of the beliefs and attitudes that they have from the books that are shared to them through the ritual of story time.
I think you bring up a really interesting point about children books. Myself, I do not have children, but a lot of my close friends started to have children 2 years ago. So most of those kids are now starting to read books or having books read to them. And one of the greatest websites that I have found in sourcing books for children is actually the website called amightygirl.com. And what they do is that they curated books that go beyond the traditional narrative of children books and the representation of those kids we see traditionally in American children books. So they take particularly care to represent all ethnicities in those books. So you can find stories featuring African-American children, Native American children. You will find a book that speaks to you personally, but also teaches people from different races about the life experience of others. And in addition to that, what I'm really happy about is that they include the stories about people from other places in the world. So there are tons of books on the experiences of girls in developing countries, in the global south, in war-torn countries. And I think what it teaches our children is that their life is just one of many life forms, and that they need to understand the experiences and histories of other people all around the world, but also develop some form of empathy with the stories of others. So not being from the US, I actually have never opened a Curious George book. So I would be just curious to know what it is about. If you could just give like a brief recap on Curious George and why you chose to focus on that.
I opened a Curious George book. I suppose I had read them as a child, but I opened a Curious George book for the first time when my girls were too young to speak and I was too tired to think. And that particular night, I opened this big yellow book, paying little attention to the concerning image of a monkey being escorted away by a police officer on the cover, and I started to read the narrative of George swinging on a vine in the African jungle, and the man in the yellow hat shows up, and he's enticed and wants to bring home a souvenir. And so he takes his big yellow hat, and he puts it on the ground, and George, and then he hides behind a tree, and George comes down and starts playing with the yellow hat, and it's so big that it actually covers him, at which point the man in the yellow hat jumps out from behind a tree, throws him into a burlap sack that tightens around his neck, and it looks as though he's choking. And at this moment, all my deliriousness of raising twins was sparked, and I thought, wow, this is really concerning. So I put down the book and picked up, you know, The Rainbow Fish, a wonderful story about a fish that shares its scales with all the other fish, and As the girls slept, I revisited Curious George with my academic lens, and I began to look scathingly for all of what I thought would be a scholarly response to such a concerning narrative. And I found one article by June Cummings written about the original first seven of over 100 titles, and that was it.
Wow, 100 titles of Curious George, too.
And it's not just Curious George books. There's Curious George movies, the Curious George musical. There's the traveling interactive exhibit of Curious George at children's museums all over the world. There are PBS has Curious George running regularly. Hulu has devoted an entire station to Curious George so that you can watch it 24 hours a day. I mean, it is so much bigger than the literary character in which he was born. It is a brand.
So do you see the same kind of narrative on colonialism that you found in the book in those other venues? I mean, I can't believe there's a musical. I'm partially now curious to see it. But
it's okay. You'll be fine without it.
And Hulu, like, do you see it replicated, the same forms that you found in the book?
So the original book is an obvious articulation. He wraps him up in the bag, puts him on a boat, sells him to a zoo, right? It's a very clear replication of African slavery. The more contemporary material on Curious George, for me, answers the question, why no critique? So Curious George has been taken up by two dominant discourses in its present form. One is that in its media, it is considered to be one of the greatest teachers of science, technology, engineering, and math.
In what way?
So the notion of curiosity is taken up by PBS, public broadcasting, as an opportunity to teach their audience of 3 to 5 year olds how to learn about the weather, how to figure out what things weigh, how to determine all sorts of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And while I think that that goal is a productive one, there is an alternative narrative that exists that I find particularly problematic. One is that George is continuously drawn to other animals and jungle imagery. It suggests almost a diasporic need to return to his initial place of origin. Secondly, each narrative is the same, whether it's a show or a book. So the man in the yellow hat leaves George alone for some reason. George goes through a series of dangerous activities, walking on high wires, you know, pranking, and getting into all sorts of mischief. Then at the end of the show or the book, the man in the yellow hat comes back, and sometime, for some reason, whatever George did is considered to be a heroic act, and that's how the tale ends. The issues I have with this is, at one level, there's a real gender dynamic, right? If the man in the yellow hat is either his owner or his father at some level, right, there's a sense of real neglect. Secondly, George has a kind of boys will be boys attitude in which, in order for him to learn these lessons, he has to undertake a variety of mischief that no decent parent would ever entail with their children. The third issue is one that might not be recognized initially, but his monkeyness, right? This architectural, he's always a monkey. First of all, there's a tail issue, whether or not, you know, this type of monkey should have a tail or not. But nevertheless, right? There's a long history of a colonization relationship that U.S. and Europeans have with monkeys. This understanding dates back to the ages of slavery, when African Americans were understood as primal and having less intellectual capabilities. So there's a real racist and sexist narrative that underwrites what is celebrated as the education of STEM. And this is where my relationship with George becomes somewhat troubled.
So the man in the yellow hat, how is that man depicted? And also, does he have a name? Do we know who he is?
So initially he was the man in the yellow hat, the typical National Geographic sunny colonizer with the boots, and he had on this, you know, yellow safari outfit. But then in 2006, the Curious George blockbuster movie came out. And when writing this movie, people realize, maybe it's not so good that we have this colonization narrative. We need to find a new way that George is going to get to America. So they rewrote the man in the yellow hat as this guy, Ted, who worked for a museum that was going under. And the owner of the museum had this idea that one of his curators, Ted, could go to Africa and find a lost shrine and bring it back, and it would bring the museum into stardom. And so this is a perfect example and where colonization has really changed. So rather than stealing people from a country, now we'll go and steal sacred sites.
But isn't that also part of colonization? Because we still have the ongoing dispute about, for example, the Museum Island in Berlin still have so many stolen artifacts from Greece, from Northern Africa, and there have been those claims to return those artifacts to the original cultures.
Absolutely. And I think there are a variety of different ways they could have gotten George to America, and the fact that they chose this one suggests that colonization is really in the contemporary moment at play.
So they just swapped out one colonization story with another.
That's correct.
A little bit less offensive to the eye, but still problematic.
Absolutely.
So how should we teach our children about post-colonialism? Do you think that Curious George is something that we should keep out of our children's homes? Do children even understand that the monkey is standing in for slaves, African-American, the devaluation of African tribes, and that the man in the yellow hat is the colonizer? Or is it a case of, like, well, the children won't understand it, so why are we concerned about?
So I'm not an advocate of a ban. I think that these types of texts become an opportunity for us to teach young children the principles of critical thinking. So my children are 8, and we've had conversations that said, really, do you think this is a good idea to take somebody away from the jungle that they live in? Do you think that it's appropriate to tie somebody up? Or would you like your dad to act like the man in the yellow hat? And so we have these conversations that to them seem really natural, really dinner time talk. But what I'm doing is beginning the critical thinking process that I hope will stay with them, so that every movie they watch, we can have that conversation. Do you really think that this girl, Ariel, who loved living under the sea and had dreams of education, should not go to school because she married this guy on land? Right? And so we have these conversations that offer up the beginning of critical thinking. And I think that George becomes an opportunity to offer that, because George is not going away. There's a third discourse of George that has emerged in the last 2 years about the Rays, the authors of Curious George, and they were, in fact, Holocaust refugees, German Jews who lived in Paris and escaped Nazi-invaded Paris to come to the United States and publish the Curious George text. And so there's a real Holocaust memorial narrative that now accompanies George.
How does that complicate, if at all, your reading of the text?
I actually think that it furthers my personal reading of the text. It certainly does not please the Jewish community that I'm writing about George in this way, but I'm hoping that my Jewishness becomes an opportunity for people to listen maybe a little bit longer than they would otherwise. Because the story of, we're at a particular moment in which World War II veterans and refugees are dying. And so there's a real desire to memorialize, to keep these stories alive. And while I think that's a fantastic goal and important to the history and memory of the Holocaust, this particular narrative is very whimsical, it's very George Adventure-like, and I think it really does a disservice to children around fifth or sixth grade who begin to learn about the Holocaust by reading Anne Frank and Elie Wiesel's Night and books that really tone in on the violence and horror of this event. I think if you're introduced to the Holocaust through this kind of adventure, fun-loving narrative, that it can be really problematic in terms of the memory narrative that we'd like to, that I'd like to see memorialized.
And then if I can ask, what would you say to people that might comment, like, I think you're just reading too much into this book?
Well, I went to the memorial, the Curious George, and what struck me was that the pictures of George's abduction in the first book were hung up next to the narrative of Ray's escaping the Nazis. And what struck me was a lack of intellectual acknowledgement that both slavery and the Holocaust were violent, horrific events that should never be replicated. And so while people say, well, you're reading too much into it, you only need to look at the leading stories of today to see what's happening in Syria and children on refugee boats and boats going through the night to escape horrific violence to say, no, it's important and it's almost an obligation to read these stories, understanding that the impacts they had. Because racism is not taught in school, it is learned. And it's learned through books like Curious George.
So are there any books that you would recommend that really do a good job in talking about colonization and post-colonialism?
Yeah, I think the fact that you mentioned the Mighty Girl website suggests that there's a lot of books out there that talk about the representations of various different cultures, and they represent appropriate and productive narratives. But recognizing that any one representation of a particular identity, race, ability, class is always already informed by our history and cannot be homogenized to emulate. So the story of one Japanese girl, it may be important, but does not describe the entire history of globalization, very informed by, say, Hello Kitty.
Well, it looks like we're about out of time. We want to thank you, Raylin, for coming to join us. We really appreciate you making the journey all the way from Western Washington University. We want to thank Jamin Anderson and, again, our guest, Dr. Raylin Schwartz-Dupree. Know Your Media is recorded at the KISU Studios on the campus of Idaho State University. The audio of this podcast can be found at PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, at prx.org.
More information about tonight's guest, Raylin Schwartz-Dupree, and her research, along with the audio of tonight's broadcast, is available at our website, kisu.org. Look for the homepage post. Coming up next, Bengal Buzz with your host, Ryan Sargent. Tonight, Ryan is joined by officers of ASISU.